Well, I had James Corbett on the show, and I was on his show, and a lot of the comments I got on YouTube and on the podcast were, you guys should work together more. I wish you would go on each other's shows more. Well, quest granted, because even though it hasn't been very long, James Corbett is back on the show, albeit a completely different topic. We will be discussing all aspects about Fukushima, not only the radiation, but the tsunami and a lot of the economic surroundings. Well, have a listen. Okay, joining me today is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and also Bullying Frogs Post, and also FukushimaUpdate.com, and that's the website I'm interested in today. 2 days ago was the third anniversary of the giant tsunami that hit Japan and flooded Miyagi and Fukushima and busted up the reactors over on Daiichi. I'm sure everyone's aware. And James, what I'd like to talk to you about today is exactly what's going on now, what problems we're still facing from Fukushima, as well as a little bit on the press coverage, because we seem to have two extreme camps. There are some alarmists that act like it's the end of the world and the worst thing that's ever happened, period, and we're all going to die of radiation tomorrow. And there's also the other side, the TEPCO and sort of government lackeys that just say, there's nothing to see here, don't worry about it, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And I hope we can talk about some middle ground, because there are plenty of things that aren't the end of the world, but are definitely worrisome and should be talked about.
There is so much to talk about in that regard, and it seems like we're always talking about that balancing act between the extremes. But I suppose, just to bring everyone on board, of course, we are talking about the 3/11 event, so the tsunami and the resulting meltdown, triple meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi, the nuclear reactor in the northeast side of the main island here in Japan. So, and of course, that tsunami is still something that we should remember in and of itself, not only for the effect that it caused at Fukushima, but I mean, it did end up killing 15,884 people confirmed, and then 2,636 people left unaccounted for. And I think by this point, 3 years later, I'm pretty sure we can safely say they're dead, or at least fake their own death. But I'm assuming most of them are dead. So again, a staggering number of people left dead by that tragedy itself. And that in and of itself caused an incredible amount of obviously human damage, but also economic damage, and shouldn't be left out of this equation, because it in and of itself is a pretty horrific thing that that affected a lot of lives here in Japan. But of course, what we are talking about are the effects that happened at Fukushima. And basically, long story short, for those who don't know, I mean, even the official line of the Japanese parliamentary panel that was set up to investigate what happened in the wake of the disaster came to the conclusion it was a man-made disaster, by which they mean it was the regulatory and government authorities and the lax, basically, policies of TEPCO that were responsible for what ended up happening at Fukushima with the triple meltdown. And
TEPCO,
I think,
is Tokyo Electric Power Company.
You should make that clear. Yes, that's the owner-operator of the Fukushima Daiichi plant. And of course, Fukushima Daiichi was a General Electric Mark I type reactor, a light water reactor, which is important because I think this gets to really the heart of the nuclear issue, and that is still remains an issue and that should not be forgotten in all of this, which is that really, I mean, at base, this is a point that I try to make in a lot of interviews, because I still don't think that the connection is very clear to a lot of people. But at base, the nuclear energy industry is really nothing else than an adjunct to the nuclear weapons industry. The way that it's been developed, the history of the nuclear energy industry as we know it, has been so incredibly influenced by the U.S. government and the U.S. military in particular, that it's hard to separate the two. And just one example of that is the fact that almost every commercial nuclear reactor in the world right now are light water reactors, which require constant circulation of water around the reactor core to keep it cool, which of course, as we see in a case like Fukushima, is an exceptionally poor design, because obviously it relies on constant supply of power to the plant. And if that goes
high
out,
pressure, and these are usually uranium and plutonium or POX, rather than thorium, which you cannot build a bomb out of. And that's, even though that's the more advanced technology, we're using the technology from the 50s, because that's what you can build a bomb out of.
That's exactly right. And of course, the reason why the light water reactor specifically, why that form was chosen, was because that goes back to World War II and Navy Admiral Hyman Rickover, who actually chose that design because it could be, at that time, with the technology they had, it could be miniaturized to fit on a submarine. And that's exactly why that reactor type was chosen. And as part of the technological lock-in of that decision, basically for decades now, we've been locked in to that form of reactor, which again is inherently unstable and in is basically prone to this exact type of disaster scenario. And it really has just...
Shapiro had a lot of influence on that. That's exactly how Israel smuggled in its nuclear material.
Which is an incredible story all to itself.
Well,
but yes, I mean...
We can pass over that, but I mean... I'll refer people to my interviews with Grant Smith or Jeff Blankford about that, but that's just an interesting point in this puzzle of the history of nuclear energy and why people choose what they choose.
And my own interviews with Grant Smith as well, we've also touched on that. So, yeah, an absolutely important story about NUMEC and all of that. But I think the point of this for me is that, I mean, nuclear power is just inherently unjustifiable on so many levels when you take a look at the very least, the way these uranium reactors have developed. And this is a point that is often obviously obscured by the politicians who have a vested interest in maintaining this illusion that nuclear power is about nuclear energy and stability of the energy system. But it was interesting in the wake of 3/11 how some of the chinks in the armor of the edifice of what has been built up here in Japan around the nuclear energy industry started to appear when, for example, we had the former Japanese defense minister Shigeru Ishiba, who was quoted as saying, quote, "I don't think Japan needs to possess nuclear weapons, but it's important to maintain our commercial reactors because it would allow us to produce a nuclear warhead in a short amount of time. It's a tacit nuclear deterrent." So I think that's one of the underlying reasons of the nuclear energy industry all around the world. And of course, it also underlies Japan in its situation here with its so-called three nuclear non-nuclear principles, where they won't house or store or use nuclear weapons of any sort, quote unquote, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And of course, that's, again, being masked by this massive nuclear energy industry, which is, again, could be put into operation to produce nuclear weapons at the flip of a switch. So
they have shut the power off since 3/11, all but the one in Osaka, which was finally turned off as well.
That's right. So we've had a complete nuclear shutdown here. There's, I believe, 52 reactors throughout the country. 51, maybe. I'm maybe one or two off on there. But they have been completely shut down, which to some extent has given the lie to the nuclear energy line here in Japan, that nuclear energy is absolutely vital and Japan would cease to function as a country without it. Obviously, that's not the case. We have seen record trade deficits on the back of the weakening yen combined with the import of LNG that's been needed to basically maintain the power supply. But at any rate, the envisioned constant energy shortages and blackouts, et cetera, have failed to materialize. And in fact, after the nationwide campaigns they had here a couple of years ago to try to keep energy use to a minimum, they actually had excess energy supplies, which was something that they didn't want to advertise too much because, again, it gives a lie to the nuclear energy industry here.
If they ever started to reach that point, they could probably turn off the pachinko lights in the middle of the day.
To anyone who has never actually entered a pachinko parlor, it is the most just horrific thing you've ever been assaulted by. It's
like
just
Las Vegas, two of Las Vegas.
Yeah, cranked up to 15 on a scale of 1 to 10. Yeah, it is bizarre, garish, annoying, and assaulting to the senses. And yes, I have no doubt accounts for a significant amount of energy, considering how popular those places tend to be, which still befuddles me. But yeah, exactly right. So that is kind of the background to this. And it's interesting from my perspective to look at how the nuclear energy industry ever developed in a country that has been the only country ever to be the victim of a nuclear bombing in wartime, which is an entire history in and of itself that, of course, involves CIA connections to the Yomiuri Shinbun and Class A war criminal Shoriki Matsutaro. Which again is an entire interesting story in and of itself.
But the mob.
Who? Yeah, exactly. Well, again, the connections to the mafia and the Japanese government here run extremely deep, especially with surrounding the nuclear issue. And of course, that's something that has also been exposed by the Fukushima crisis, as we start to find out about some of the connections between the underworld and how they've been supplying some of the workers at for TEPCO at the plant, etc. So
now,
again,
I could get in trouble just talking about this because of the new state secrecies.
Yes, well, that's a whole other issue, isn't it? Because, well, it's obviously related, but that's something that has come up from a lot of my listeners. They've wondered sort of how this affects us at the kind of everyday level here in Japan. And of course, I don't know, I can't speak for you, but from my own perspective, of course, I haven't seen this any of the effect of this directly. And I certainly don't think that this is really targeting kind of online English language bloggers in Japan, which I'm pretty sure fly under the radar for the most part.
Well, I'm not paying you for this report, so technically we're not breaking the law.
Well, yeah, this isn't paid journalism, I suppose, in that sense. But still, I think the overall effect of this is a chilling effect. Obviously, there will be fewer government sources and leaks, etc., for people who are afraid of the ramifications of this. So it's more of a chilling effect than some sort of overt, I think, throwing people in jail. Although, who knows? I'm sure they could turn up the heat on that if they want to. But of course, I think most people who are listening to this conversation around the world probably aren't interested in all of this as it affects Japan generally. They're probably interested in how this affects them and the idea that there is this radioactive death cloud shrouding the planet that is going to fry us and incinerate us all in the next few years, which again is an idea that has taken on a lot of prominence in the alternative media in recent years. And
James, haven't you seen the meme on Facebook with the yellow scribbles all over the ocean? That proves it.
Yeah, well, if you're referring to the chart that gets thrown around, that's the NOAA chart of the wave heights from the tsunami itself, which was thrown around and used as an example of presumably, I guess the idea was that this was supposed to show the spread of the radiation from the disaster, which looked very menacing indeed if people took it that way. But of course, that's not what it was about. It was about wave heights. So yes, I mean, that's just one symptom of a kind of a greater disease that I think has swept around the globe, which is hysteria and hype surrounding the radioactive release, which is not something that I think is not a concern of any sort. But I think that what this has shown is that the public's understanding of radiation, how it works, what the dangers are, what kinds of elements are dangerous and in what way they are dangerous, how they're likely to enter any given ecosystem, how we can test for them, et cetera, et cetera. It has really shown the public's massive ignorance on these issues. And it's been really an eye-opener for me because...
Beyond ignorance, false confidence. Because they don't know that they don't know. They think they do know when they don't know. And the other dangerous part is the more the alarmists go around saying these things and they get dismissed and debunked, you have this possibility of sort of the baby out with the bathwater. So people hear that enough times and dismiss it. But then when there is an actual problem, they just group that in and go, oh, that's nothing. They always lie. And they shouldn't be doing that.
Well, that's exactly right. Because there are real risks to this. But I think you're right. When there is that boy that cried wolf scenario where, for example, I'm sure you saw that story that creeped up in December where there was some footage. The TEPCO has live feeds of what's happening at the plant. And there was some footage of some wafts of steam that came from Reactor 3.
That all year.
Exactly. This was the part of the story that didn't get picked up on. It had been doing that. I believe the first one was picked up in June or something like that. So this was nothing new, but it was new, I guess, to whoever decided to report on this, which the main outlet that I saw as the originator of this story about the radioactive steam that was going to engulf the United States was actually an outfit that I won't name by name to avoid giving them any undue attention, But
kill starfish in California, James.
Oh, yes. Well, apparently so. No, but this was an outfit that that was founded by a quote-unquote white supremacist who was also an FBI informant. So that should give you an example of who is, you know, circulating these types of rumors. But exactly right. So this was suddenly picked up and linked to all sorts of things, including, as you say, starfish wasting disease and these other phenomena that are happening in the oceans right now. And so, for example, on FukushimaUpdate.com, I posted some of the debunkings of that. For example, the starfish one in particular was a phenomenon that had started and was first noted, I believe, in 2008 and was documented in great detail by some scientists in that time period in 2008, 2009, 2010, before 3.11, before Fukushima ever took place. So this is a documented observed phenomenon that was happening on the west coast of the United States and Canada years ago. And now, suddenly, because Fukushima has happened, people are now linking that to Fukushima, where, of course, this is cause and effect in reverse. So, or not even cause and effect, it's not even related.
Starting with the conclusion and working backwards.
Right, exactly right. Again, just another example of how this piles on. And everything in this scenario becomes further proof of the preordained conclusion that this radioactive death cloud is killing everything. And
prior to Fukushima, it was all HAARP.
That was exactly answer, right. Yeah, exactly. There are these things that have these explanatory powers for people that simply by their very nature cannot be disproved because they explain everything. And there doesn't have to be any exact. It's interesting because the more that there is information to debunk these claims, for example, pointing out that the starfish wasting disease was first noted in 2008, the more that type of evidence comes out, the stronger people seem to get in their conviction that any of that evidence is being presented by obviously government paid shills or what have you. It seems to entrench people even further in their kind of their mentality that again, the only evidence they'll ever accept is evidence that proves what they're thinking. And to my mind, this is extremely interesting because it's kind of the same thing. I have no idea. I've never actually talked to you about this. I have no idea your position on the global warming issue. But for myself personally, I notice the exact type of environmental alarmism and alarmists who are promoting that, what I take to be an overblown threat, and are now using that exact same type of rubric to look at the Fukushima threat. And
yeah, it's the sky is falling thing. And yeah, with global warming, assuming it's man-made and assuming it's going on, you have to remember that a lot of these same people like Michael Mann were saying that the world was freezing in the 70s. And you look at the political solutions, I don't think we should be polluting anyway. I don't need the sky is falling Chicken Little scenario to say I don't want to pollute everything. But the solutions they've offered with the carbon credits and all that don't even reduce CO2 anyway. They just create monopolies for large agribusiness to gobble up the credits so that smaller farms and competitors have to gamble with whether they want to just sell off their emission allotment or to actually do work and farm. And of course, they're going to sell off their emission allotment, but that gives somebody else a monopoly over the distribution of these gases, because it's not only CO2, it's methane and other things. If you remember a few years ago where they're blaming cow poop for causing global warming. But the hockey stick thing was the graph that Mann and company came out with was completely debunked. It's actually gone the opposite direction. And so you see these and people say, well, how could such a huge thing, how could it have such consensus from, you know, all these scientists? But the scientists were basing their numbers on the IPCC's numbers, which were fudged. It's a UN organization. It's completely polluted by politics. And if you don't remember, folks, you know, they said that smoking was healthy for 25 years and because of the tobacco lobby. Politics pollutes science. And so, you know, be a little bit more open-minded on the issue. Don't be dismissive to people or call them crazy or deniers or something like that. I'm neutral on the issue because I've looked at the science, and as far as I can see, I don't believe in global warming, but I'm not rigidly stuck in that position, because I don't know. I'm a little agnostic, but I know for a fact that the political solutions that have been offered aren't even reducing what CO2 emissions are doing what they're saying. It's just a gambit to reallocate resources and gain more monopolies for giant agribusinesses and petrochemical companies and so on.
Well, right. You raise the important point that obviously, I mean, the pollution is a bad thing and we shouldn't be doing it anyway, regardless of its supposed effect on the climate. And I think that the climate idea and the alarmism that surrounds that is a convenient kind of lever for that, which brings in these NGOs and other groups that then can lobby about this as kind of the green cover for what is really a political agenda about control and
when
carbon
I was a
credits.
Kid, it was all the hole in the ozone. That's all they talked about.
Exactly.
High school, and then they shut up about it.
Well, one of my awakening incidents with regard specifically to environmental alarmism was as a child. Exactly. I had been exposed to that throughout the entire 1980s, throughout the whole my early formative years. I was exposed to this, and we studied it in school, and we made posters to raise awareness in the school or whatever about the hole in the ozone. And then I remember specifically watching a newscast. I must have been about 12 years old. And it was sort of, you know, 2/3 of the way into the newscast just before they throw it over to the sports guy, kind of just in passing. Oh, by the way, the hole in the ozone layer seems to be repairing itself and we don't know why. Now off to Bob with sports, you know, and that just struck me so.
They've been there a lot longer than we thought too. But you know, if you read Separation of Business and State, and I gave the examples of what happened to our island from environmental organizations, and a lot of these people are just predatory lawyers with a theme. It's like education or the environment. They have a very kind of do-gooder label, and they can act with a sense of impunity because everybody's pro-environment, everybody's pro-education, so they don't really look into it very deeply, and they get away with murder.
Right, exactly, quite literally. And I guess that should bring us back to the topic at hand, because we kind of got off onto the tangent there. But really, when we look at Fukushima, there are genuine concerns. And of course, specifically in the Fukushima area where there are, I mean, it's just heartbreaking to look at the way that people have been displaced by this. There are refugees, there are evacuees who still have not returned to their homes, many of whom probably never will at this rate.
Well, and who sleeping on the floor in gymnasiums. And yet the government, and this is both parties, by the way, wasted an enormous amount of money that was supposed to be for the victims of Fukushima and spent it on all kinds of things that were completely unrelated.
And perhaps even more vexing, the money that has already been pledged to them, directly to them, that supposedly they're able to receive from TEPCO. There are people who have basically never been able to even begin filling out the paperwork to do this, let alone to actually receive any payments for it, such that there is an ongoing class action lawsuit between many of the evacuees and TEPCO over the handout of this. So again, people are still being affected by this. There are still children who are in the Fukushima area, within that zone around the Fukushima plant, who are still play indoors. They do not play outdoors because there are so many areas that still have not been decontaminated. The decontamination that's gone on in the area has been largely a con that just basically involved spraying some hoses, spraying everything with water and calling it a day, even though there are still detectable increased radiation levels. There's been, all the brouhaha over the government raising radiation levels acceptable radiation levels, including radiation levels for children. And then later on having to admit, as they did, that was done not for scientific reasons, but simply to allay public concerns, which again caused another uproar here.
They're exporting their trash to the radioactive or contaminated soil and trash to other prefectures where it's cut with regular trash, and then they burn it just to get around the small regulations they do have that say, well, you can't burn this stuff, but if you mix it with normal trash and spread it around enough, then you can burn it.
Exactly right, which gets back to the point of what are the different vectors by which this radiation can and is entering the ecosystem. And of course, one of them is through the incineration of waste products around the country here. But of course, during the few months of the original, on the onset of this disaster, it was the fallout that was happening directly into the atmosphere, that was being belched out into the atmosphere and then rained down. A lot of it happening in that section of Japan and around there, including over Tokyo, where there was something in Japan called the SPEEDI system, SPEEDI, which is an acronym that I can't ever remember what it stands for, but basically a system that's designed specifically to forecast fallout for nuclear emergencies. And the media was denied access to the SPEEDI data during the first few weeks of this crisis, And it was later pointed out, they eventually got this data months later, and it was pointed out that basically it showed that the forecast showed there would be radiation fallout over Tokyo, which presumably is exactly why the media was denied it, even though it is a publicly funded and supposedly publicly available scientific resource that was specifically designed specifically for these types of emergencies. So again, cover-ups have been ongoing, and even some of the latest cover-ups that now affect the Nuclear Regulatory Council in the United States. NBC News has just gotten hold of FOIA documents that prove that the NRC was deliberately misleading the public about what it knew about the Fukushima disaster. For example, a PR manager was writing in an email to his colleagues, while we know more than these say, we're sticking to this story for now, et cetera, et cetera. So we know there have been ongoing cover-ups, and we know that this has been going on since the very beginning. In fact, that it took them 2 months to even admit there had been a meltdown, let alone a triple meltdown at the plant. Other basic information was kept from the public, as former Prime Minister Naoto Kan now admits, specifically to prevent the public from worrying. And of course, one of the options that was on the table that they were at least considering to consider was the evacuation of Tokyo in a worst case scenario, which was immediately taken off the table because, of course, that would be the end of Japan as a functioning country, and they just couldn't contemplate even thinking about that. So that's the kind of cover up we're dealing with, and it is very serious, and it is an ongoing concern that is continuing to leak radioactive materials into the ocean, and this is a concern. But again, as you say, there's the other side of this coin, which is the alarmism that I think really does dilute some of the very real information about what's coming out from Fukushima and how it really affects people around the globe. And just a specific example I really did want to mention, because I think it's a good example of this, was that recent viral video that took place on a beach in, I believe, San Francisco, where someone was walking around the beach with their Geiger counter and basically getting a high CPM indicating, oh, well, there's a radioactive source around here. And of course, by the logic of the internet, well, this could only possibly be from Fukushima. That was quickly debunked by people who actually knew how to use these radiation instruments to read what kind of radiation it was, and it was not the type of radiation that had the signature of the radioactive materials that were coming from Fukushima. However, that does raise the question of where these high readings of radioactivity on the beach were coming from, because they were there, but it was not coming from the other side of the world where this Fukushima event was taking place. Partly it was because of the sand on the beach itself, but I think it also goes to show that there are all sorts of radiation sources that are local, for example, to the United States, that make certain areas of the United States much more radioactive than certain parts of Japan.
Oh, yeah, which they set off plenty of test bombs in their own deserts.
This is exactly part of the point. Certainly there was the decades of open air nuclear testing, which has left an identifiable trace of, for example, cesium in the radioactive cesium in the ocean, which is still
nuclear waste into Indian reservations.
Absolutely right. And of course, still an ongoing concern. And there are all sorts of other, you know, data points that have come out in the last few years, including, for example, I remember there was a story in the Toronto Star that came out about there was this nuclear processing facility in the Toronto suburbs that no one knew about until finally it was announced a few years ago. Oh, yeah, this is a nuclear processing facility. And oh, yeah, there's all sorts of radioactive leaks that have taken place as a result of this that are only now kind of coming to light. And I think it shows that there are many sources of radiation and radioactive disasters waiting to happen, really, that are local to North America that can be now conveniently covered over because people will only be looking at Fukushima as the only possible source of radioactivity, which is a pretty good cover, I think, for the nuclear industry in North America to basically cover over all their sins and to say, oh, look, it's all coming from the other side of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, even though the Geiger counters can't get the same readings even in Osaka or even Tokyo.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if it's not right next to Fukushima, there's no way it went to California. Oh, the wind only blew that direction the entire time. No.
Right. And again, we can actually measure the radioactive plume in the ocean. It can be measured. Now, here's another interesting point. It is not being measured. There is not a single federal agency in the United States that is measuring the waters off the Pacific coast. And that is a cause for concern. So, of course, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, which I believe is based in Maine, has taken upon itself the idea of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding the effort to actually test some of this water. And they've started doing so and have released some of their preliminary results. But they're actually going through this. I think it's called ourradioactiveocean.org. I'm going to say that's ourradioactiveocean.org is the website that people can go to, and they can help crowdfund that effort if they are actually interested in the real radiation readings that can be done. The early readings have shown that that there is, in fact, at this point, not the main part of the radioactive plume certainly has not reached the west coast of the United States yet. It is due to really start arriving this year, which again means how could this viral video that was taken place in San Francisco months ago, how could this have been an example of a radioactive plume that has not reached the shores of North America yet? Unless, of course, it was that radioactive fallout in the atmosphere that stopped almost 2.5 years ago now. So again, it just goes to expose all sorts of weak points in people's understanding. But I think the interesting part of this is, again, the more people have basically bought onto the narrative that this is the extinction level event, we are all going to die, the more they hear evidence to the contrary, the further entrenched in their position they become, and the less they want to hear it. So that any good news, any news that any sane person would say, well, that's a good thing. Oh, you mean the radioactive plume hasn't even arrived really at the North America yet? Well, that's a good thing. Most people would actually be relieved to hear something like that. But there are a lot of people out there that get angry because clearly this is part of the cover up. So it just creates this feedback loop where the only news sources people will listen to are the ones that say the most outrageous things, really, and the ones that will confirm their bias that that basically the end is nigh and we're all going to die.
Well, fear sells. How many times have you gotten an email, a personal email, saying, get out of there, save yourself?
On pretty much a weekly basis at this point, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the same old, but talking about the water, where you're saying it's leaking, or they're actually purposely putting some of the radioactive water into the ocean, is that going to affect the fish? People, I'm paying devil's advocate. Isn't that going to poison the ocean if they're doing that on purpose? I mean, it's radioactive, or how diluted is it per day?
Well, actually, it does have a noticeable and a detectable impact on the fish, for example, in the Fukushima Bay region. And this is something that is obviously being monitored here in Japan. And there have been throughout this disaster, there have been times at which the Japanese government has declared it perfectly safe. Oh, all the seafood's okay. Fukushima fish went back into the Tokyo markets, etc. And then they found, I believe it was in August or September of last year, they found another fish with record levels of radiation that again shows that their monitoring is haphazard at best. And that's in fact exactly why myself and my family here are being extremely selective about seafood that we eat. Basically, unless we know where it's coming from, we're not going to eat it. And that's just one of the precautions that we take here. And I think that's sensible, because the real danger, I think, at this point...
Well, it is a lot easier to buy local in Japan.
It is. And I do appreciate that there is a lot of detailed labeling here about specifically what prefectures produce, etc., are coming from. The question being whether how much you want to trust that, and how much you can trust some of the labeling that goes on here, given some of the food scandals we've seen in recent years in this country.
I'm in Nard. I get it right off the farm. So
yes, exactly, and there is a very good kind of local farming infrastructure here. Most families here in Japan have their own farm and will actually pick fresh produce on a regular basis. So. It is a good culture in that sense, and I do really appreciate that. We also use something here called Green Co-op, which is basically just a cooperative that that sources organic, in fact, non-GMO and ingredients for all of their products. And in fact, they do radiation testing, and they post the results of that. So that's another way that we are keeping track of what we're ingesting, because this is really one of the main concerns, I think, for people in Japan, is the actual ingestion of this. This is the way it's getting into the ecosystem and into the food chain, is through the radiation that's leaking out into the ocean. And of course, in the early stages of this disaster, when the fallout was still fresh, obviously in the spring and summer of 2011, it was the leafy vegetables that you had to be concerned about, and then the root vegetables after that that were sucking up the radioactive fallout. Obviously, again, my wife and I were avoiding anything that came from that part of Japan as just our precaution against that. And this is still an ongoing concern because, of course, with Chernobyl, that was the key intake of the iodine-131 that was part of the radioactive fallout from the Chernobyl disaster. It was getting into the milk supply, which then got into children. And there was a lot of cases of thyroid cancer as a result of that. And depending which statistics you'll read and who you'll listen to, it was either as few as 9 people and as many as 1 million people that died as a result of that fallout in Chernobyl. So there's considerable debate, that's maybe a whole other thing to think about. But it helps to throw into focus what's happening here, because, again, it's a question of how people think this is going to actually physically get into their system and how it actually operates, which, again, is often left kind of vague in some way. Like when a new leak is discovered at the Fukushima plant that has readings, you know, a million times higher than ever been discovered before, or something like that, it obviously makes headlines and gets people worried. But the question in my mind would be, for people who, for example, are in the United States listening to this conversation, how a puddle at the Fukushima site is going to directly affect someone sitting on the other side of the planet. Again, there's not a lot of understanding how this works. It's just sort of a general thing that's in the environment that will somehow leach into the universe and pollute everything. When, of course, again, basic understanding.
The only thing that can do that is John McCain.
he'll appear anywhere there is a disaster, or Donald Rumsfeld, but I guess he's getting too old for it.
His existence pollutes the universe.
But again, that's just another point I'd like to make. Again, there are different types of radioactive substances that have different effects. There are alpha emitters and beta emitters and gamma rays, and they all have different effects and different ways of basically getting into the human system.
Bananas are radioactive. And gamma rays just turn you into the Hulk. Everyone knows that.
Well, everyone knows that. Meet Bruce Banner, hit by gamma rays, the ever-loving Hulk. That just goes to show how I watched Marvel cartoons as a youngster. But for example, with these puddles that are discovered at the Fukushima site that have however many times record levels of radiation, these are generally beta emitters, which means that even a piece of paper would be enough to protect you from that radiation in that sense. So clothing is enough to do it. In order to get the kind of lethal doses that they sometimes talk about, you know, it would kill a man in 2 hours, you would basically have to go and literally put your face directly up to the puddle and just sit there for 2 hours for it to have that effect at all. Because again, even a thin fabric coating would actually be a barrier against that type of radiation.
A Ron Swanson mustache would protect you.
it probably would. So the point, again, is, well, it depends. So for example, beta emitters would be dangerous if ingested. Obviously, that would be a concern. And that's, again, why we have to be concerned about this getting into the food chain and
the
food
supply. The other thing, you talked about the green co-op, but something like TPP could actually crush their ability to label things and to check for things the way they want to.
Exactly right. And again, I hope people are aware of this. I'm sure they've at least heard of this by now. But for people who don't know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that's still currently being negotiated, it was due to even be wrapped up by December. But thankfully, it's not quite made it there yet. But you're right. I mean, this, again, we don't have full details about what's in it, because only the people who are negotiating it have access to the document. But we understand that it involves such things as the ability of countries to create labeling laws to be able to say, for example, this is genetically modified or not genetically.
To the lowest common denominator. So if the U.S. or one of these other partners have a really low standard, then so will everyone else. And you can actually even be dragged to court.
Exactly right, yes.
Well, a lot of the reporting on TPP has been about screwballery around the internet, but I'm a little bit more concerned about agriculture, and that hasn't really had the spotlight or attention that it deserves. And
well, it has in Japan too, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but not worldwide, not in the U.S. And a lot of the cover English speaking media anyway.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yes. So I don't want people to leave this conversation thinking that I think everything's tickety-boo and A-okay, but I also don't want people to go away thinking it's a extinction-level event or it's nothing. You know, I mean, it's that kind of duality and extremism that I think is to our detriment, because it really boxes people into corners where they literally cannot accept information that goes against whatever they might think. Mm-hmm. So that's really an editorial decision that I made early on with Fukushima Update, is that it presents information from both sides of that extreme, as well as things that if anything really does exist in the middle, so much of it really is extremized. But it really is just a source for information about Fukushima. And it's not me saying that I verify and put my personal stamp of authority on everything that goes up on Fukushima Update. It really is for people out there to decide. But I am trying to sample stories from all over the spectrum. And I should also point out that Fukushima Update is being mostly maintained on a daily basis by Brock West of APPerspective.net. And if your listeners have never encountered AP Perspective, I hope they will. It's a great source of information on the Asia-Pacific region generally. And Brock is doing an excellent job keeping Fukushima Update up to date with all the latest.
Well, maybe I'll talk to him too.
You definitely should. I'll get you in touch.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll do that. Well, James, we're out of time today, but thank you. We covered a lot of bases. I think we at least touched on all these issues so that people can research on their own now any aspect of that, the wasted money, TPP, the censorship of the press, radiation, different types of radiation, the levels, debunking a lot of the ridiculous stuff, the maps, etc. Because a lot of that, they're all related, and people say, well, that's a different subject. No, it isn't. That all of that, the trade agreements, everything, the press, that all is
the nuclear weapons industry.
The nuclear weapons industry, exactly. Why do we use uranium anyway when we have thorium and other options or green energy, etc.? So that's all one big picture, and that's how geopolitics is. You can't segment it into clean little categories. They bleed into each other, and you have to have a holistic picture or you don't really have a picture at all.
Amen to that. I think that's exactly right.
Well, thanks, and I look forward to interviewing you again or going on your show. We've been ping-ponging back and forth in the last couple weeks on each other's shows, but this was coincidental. I mean, I was talking about the Ukraine because something happened in the Ukraine, and I had you on because you are the webmaster for Fukushima Update, and this was the anniversary of the tsunami, so that's just how it landed. But I do appreciate it every time you come on, and I look forward to each time we have an interview, and I hope we can do it more in the future.
I'm looking forward to it, too. Talk to you again.
All right. Thank you. That was James Corbett of Corbett Report and FukushimaUpdate.com.